sometimes people will say, you know, well, I believe in God, like it's an inherent good. But what I care more about is, what is the God you believe in asking of you? Is our belief in God asking us to bring our conscience and our honesty and our humility and our willingness to keep growing and the expectation to love even when we're not getting the validation or approval or reinforcement that we want, right? That's really, really important, is what does my belief ask of me, and am I willing to offer it?
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Jennifer, welcome to Sanctuary. I am really looking forward to this conversation and really grateful for you just to take the time to join me.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into things, for anyone who happens to not know who you are, I know that you are beloved in the LDS community and especially the Faith Matters community, but in case anyone tuning in is unfamiliar with who you are, could you just give us a little introduction into what you do, maybe like why you're passionate about what you do?
Yeah, well, I grew up in the church and learning a lot about marriage and how much it matters, and actually really looking very much forward to getting married and being a mother and all those things. But I also noticed people in my ward and around me that were not happily married. They had like their seven children between them on the bench in sacrament meeting, and they looked happy to be separate. And, you know, this was just like, I don't know what it was, but I, at an early age, was really interested in the question of what helps people be happily married. So I got my PhD in counseling psychology. I wrote my dissertation on LDS women and sexuality, just really looking at which LDS women transitioned happily into marriage and which did not, and how had they internalized the messages that they'd received. And then I went from that into really working primarily with LDS couples around their marriages and specifically their intimate relationships. So my work has been about doing counseling and coaching with couples, teaching, podcasting on these topics. And most recently, I wrote a book with Faith Matters as the publisher called That We Might Have Joy. That's really a culmination, I think, of this work of how our spirituality and sexuality are connected and how our capacity for intimacy is deeply linked to our spirituality.
That's amazing. I feel like your voice is a voice we've been waiting for, like so many in our community have been waiting for a long time. There's so many people in my personal community, especially women, who your work has just been so meaningful to, and me included. So thank you for what you're doing. It really is leaving a huge impact. It feels so important. Yeah. Okay. So to kind of get into what I'm envisioning for this conversation today, I have followed your work a bit over the years. I've listened to some of your podcasts and read some of your work. Haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I am excited to check that out. But something that I've heard you speak on quite a handful of times is these stages of development, self-development, spiritual development, that have offered such a helpful and insightful framework for just kind of making sense of my own spiritual journey, my own just journey as a human on earth. And had the thought that it would be insightful to have an exploration of the five covenants that are made inside the temple from this framework. Yeah. Kind of to give a little context for myself, I went through a conversion experience almost exactly five years ago, where grew up LDS, but I left for about 8 years at the age of 15 or 16, kind of went on my own journey of seeking and learning and just really trying to resolve my own pains and brokenness that I felt in my life. And 5 years ago, went through this very unexpected conversion experience, and there was a rupture in my life where pretty immediately I entered into an entirely new identity. Everything about my life basically changed. I had an entirely new identity. after encountering Jesus Christ. My relationships changed. The purpose of my life changed. Even like how I looked, like everything about myself and my life changed 5 years ago. And I entered into this new rule of life, if you will, that initially started with just identifying as a Christian and a disciple of Jesus Christ. But a few months later, also including remembering myself to the LDS faith and everything that comes with that. And I say all this because I've, over the last 5 years, witnessed a lot of change in the way that I approach and relate to my faith and my relationship with God. You know, initially, it felt very black and white, like either it was right or it was wrong. And everything was quite simple in that way. And I really leaned on the security I felt in just obeying the rules and feeling that structure. And I felt such a desperate need to have God just hold my hand every step of the way and just tell me what to do, walk me through it, because everything was brand new and it was too much for me. I didn't have the capacity to think and feel my way beyond that. But as time went on, I had felt greater capacity for more depth and more nuance in faith, but also I felt a greater need within myself to actually start to ask questions and wrestle, like, with why am I doing the things that I'm doing and what does this mean and what am I stepping into? So I've loved your language around these stages of development, and I thought that we could just begin with you kind of giving us a rundown of these three stages of development and what it means to develop a sense of self or a self-concept that you've shared.
Sure. Let me just give a little bit of framing, which is that there's a lot of developmental theorists out there. And so some people describe human development in 11 stages, some do it in 2 stages. And, you know, I had read a lot of those theories and thought about those things a lot. But in writing my book, I wanted a way to kind of talk about why sometimes early in our development, sexuality and spirituality feel so incongruent. And as we grow, you know, line upon line, grow into a wiser self, into a deeper resonance with what is true, we start to see how deeply connected they can be. So I think I just wanted to give framing to that to help people kind of understand where they are, where they might be getting stuck, how we sometimes take the letter of the law, for example, to be what really matters while betraying the spirit of the law. And so fear is often what's keeping us hindered, and the ways that we talk to each other about faith. This is my way of just saying, like, reading a lot of these things, this is my best attempt to kind of capture what I think people are doing. But in the first stage, it's what I call the egocentric stage, and I'm borrowing some of Robert Keegan's language with that. This is where we all start, that we see the world in relatively simple terms. And very specifically in that first stage of development, we see the world in the terms of how it impacts us. And so we think about our morality that way too. That is that, you know, if just thinking about a child, I want to obey the rules because I don't want to get in trouble. So it's not about, you know, I shouldn't lie because that could hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. Or it could take advantage of somebody. A child's thinking about, I don't want to lie because I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want my parents to punish me. And so that self-reference is just part of the process. We have to start there. And one of our primary concerns in that first stage is our safety and our gratification, keeping ourselves safe and also getting what we want out of life. And so we're thinking about how to keep authority figures happy with us so that we are okay. You know, and I remember my older brother, when I was about 5, being in the sandbox, and he's teaching me about God, and he's telling me, well, because we belong to the true church, when the second coming happens, you won't burn because you got the right answer. But Amy, your Catholic best friend, she will, you know. And so I remember being kind of like, wow, this guy, God is intense, you know, he's a tough guy, all right? But I'm glad I got the answer right. So that is, it was sort of reinforcing of a kind of narcissism in my 5-year-old self, like, okay, well, we got it right. So I'm good, I'm safe. But those other people, they're not God's children in quite the same way, right? So we think in sort of us, them, we think more tribally. We think more black and white. And it's about keeping God happy with us. That's our primary motivation. Now, that's an important place to start. It's kind of setting up the reality that there is good and there is evil, that there is right and there is wrong, that doing what is wrong can actually interfere with our well-being, right? That it makes sense to hold mom's hand when you cross the street. It's going to keep you safer. So, you know, I don't want it, people to think of, well, this is like the wrong way to think. What I would say, it's a foundational way to think. It's where we start to learn impulse control. Right. If I keep moving around and, you know, just doing whatever my body dictates, people get mad at me. I get put in timeout. I have consequences. And so that framing helps us start to learn to regulate our choices. Now, most people start to grow beyond stage one at about age 8, about the time when we start being able to think about the concept of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. You start thinking about, how does that feel to my sister? What is it that my mom actually needs, feels, and wants? We start to think more socially. And I'll talk about stage 2 in a minute, that social stage, which is very important. But for those of us that grew up in chaotic homes or abusive homes or homes that were highly unpredictable, we can either struggle to move into the next stage or quickly regress into the first stage because there's not enough predictability that we are able to sort out our own impulses because we are on some level of alert all the time. And the other thing I would say is, even if you live most of your life in stage 3, which I'll get to, if we're under enough fear and pressure, we can easily regress back to this stage. So lest anybody listening thinks, oh, I'm so in stage 3 and I really feel sorry for those stage 1 people. We all can regress. You know, somebody cuts you off and you're going to be stage 1, you know, thinking of somebody as all bad and you're all good and so on. But in terms of thinking about who God is, you know, we see God in this early stage as punisher or provider of blessings. And so we might go to the temple, we might obey the rules because, you know, we need to put blessings in the bank, you know, that we need those blessings to protect us. And so we're doing these things like a vending machine of blessings in that early stage. Keep God pleased with us, then I will have God's favor. And so it's very externally, it's in some sense very egocentric, but it's very much about keeping an external reality happy. In the second stage, when we grow into that, then we start thinking about, what matters? What is the language of the group? What's the moral language of my group? What do they value? What are the principles that I need to learn? What are the commandments, the codes of conduct that are going to help me get there, like the law of chastity? You start understanding deeper principles behind these ideas, but you're still very much in an external reference of authority. Now, you're starting to think less egocentrically. You're starting to think about, how does my behavior impact others? How do I cooperate with others? How do we create something that's good for them and good for me? So we're starting to think more socially, but we haven't really learned to think independently. So that is to say, we think like our group thinks. We've inherited those principles, and we need to. It's a language that we need to start building capacity, to start cooperating, to start working within a group, to start thinking about how we affect other people. But, you know, in this stage, you might not lie, not because you're afraid you're going to get in trouble entirely. It's more that I don't want someone that I value to think of me as a liar. I don't want to lose status in their eyes. Mm. And I don't want to hurt them. So there's both operating at once in this stage. Mm. And the church and, you know, our covenants and so on, they're very good at getting us to this stage because we're working within a system, and there's consequences when we don't kind of hold our part in that system. Institutions are generally good at helping us live in this social stage of cooperation and principle-based action. The third stage, though, and most people don't go into the third stage, but it's really where we start growing out of the letter of the law and more deeply into the spirit of the law. It's where we've internalized these principles enough that we have a deeper internal reference. Now, it's not incongruent with our relationship with God, but it's not as, you know, in the second stage, you see God as a friend and a parent and someone who you want to please and keep happy with you so that you feel beloved, you feel you belong. Mm. When you move into stage three, you trust that relationship more. You're less in need of trying to make sure God is happy with you, but you're more deeply aligned with true principles. And you're more of an agent and an actor within those true principles. And so you've learned the rules well in stages one and two, but you're less concerned about how it's going to affect you or how it looks to others, and much more concerned about what is in fact good and true. You've developed an internal compass through stages one and two. And in stage three, you're more able to be anxiously engaged in a good cause, not needing to be commanded in all things, more able to act within the spirit of a principle because you truly understand it well. Now, it's very different than rebellion, because some people think, oh, this is a flawed system and I don't want anything to do with it, so I'm pushing against it. I'm going to do the opposite of what it says, right? Many of us can do that. It's a kind of defiance. We go from a compliant position in stage one or two to a defiant one. But the defiance is still dependent upon the authority that you're pushing against. And so it's still a dependent behavior. It's often driven by hatred or anger or self-righteousness, but it's still dependent. In stage three, you're really bringing your deepest conscience and deepest responsibility to your choices to really be God's hands, to really enact goodness in the world, but with less dependency on other people telling you it's okay, and more self-honesty and integrity-driven action.
That is so fascinating. It just feels so helpful to just to have a vision for what we're moving into individually and as a community, as a collective. And it's just something I'm thinking of as you're speaking is how differently we might interpret sacred texts depending on where we're at on our journey. And even how, like for the writer, like how our experience and where we're at on our own personal developmental journey is filtering life and God and interpreting things a particular way. I'm feeling curious about that. Yeah,
100%. I think that we so often, I think this is going to be a poor quote of Richard Rohr, but he said something like, we don't see the world, okay, I can't remember the quote, but basically as it is, we see the world as we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we filter through the lens that we are bringing to our experience or to sacred text or to a spiritual ritual. And we can't help but do that. I mean, that's all we have. We're looking through a glass darkly and we're trying to sort out what is good and what is right. I think what Christ was critical of was when we would use our egocentrism, our pride, our self-reinforcement to not move forward, right? So the Sadducees and the Pharisees, they liked the hierarchy that's often a part of stage one and stage two. They liked the idea that they were better than other people because they lived the rules better. They were uninterested in loving and seeing and caring about all of God's children. And so they were using religion to prop themselves up at the expense of truth and growth. And of course, we can all do these things, but I think when we sin is when we refuse to kind of keep growing, keep waking up to ourselves, keep seeing the ways that we might use our faith in ways that actually limit us, limit our growth, prop up our sense of self at the expense of love or truth.
Right. I love that you pointed out as you were describing these three stages that there's clearly wisdom in each stage. It's not that...
Yeah. Right.
You know, you're just this immature, undeveloped human that needs to grow up depending on where you're at. There's clearly medicine and wisdom in each stage.
Yes.
And also always more beckoning us forward.
That's right. It's like the rings of a tree. You have to start in the center. You need to build that core, that foundation. And then using that foundation, you grow into the next stage. And using that foundation, you grow into the next one. And I think oftentimes we feel like, especially from stage 2 to 3, it's what Mary Beth Raines called the continental divide in human development. When we go from that external reference to a deeper internal reference, often we experience a disorientation in it. We feel a sense of loss. We feel faith crisis or faith questions, and we feel like something's going terribly wrong because we're starting to listen to our own conscience or have questions about, is this as true as I thought, or is this in fact good? And rather than something going wrong, that is a part of developing a deeper, richer, truer faith and just part of the process.
Yeah, that's helpful because it can feel really destabilizing to feel some of these transitions that I think are inevitable for all of us.
Yes.
Definitely. To one degree or another. So yeah, once again, this framework is just really helpful to feel that there's a language for what's happening.
And one thing I would actually say is these transitions aren't necessarily inevitable because sometimes we just cling to what we know in the name of faith, cling to our fears, and kind of refuse to know the person who thinks differently, refuse to love the person who approaches their faith in a different way because we are afraid. And so sometimes we resist our growth out of fear while calling it faith. Rather than believing in love and goodness enough to withstand knowing and loving others, that the truth reveals itself in that process.
That feels so important right now. I think this is something I want to touch on a bit later, but just feeling the tension of the difference of where someone is at, how they are relating to their faith, how they're relating to their belief systems and their identity. And that can feel uncomfortable to feel like, okay, so are they right or am I right? Not just in a church community, but I think at the world at large right now, we're being asked in a really big way to increase our capacity to just hold the difference and hold each other and where we're at in the different expressions of that.
It's so hard. You know, complexity is always hard, and simplicity obviously is easier, or a black and white world. And when we're afraid, we want to regress into it. Similarly, I would say hatred is easy. Binary thinking is easy. Love is hard. Holding on to other people who are coming from a different perspective. How did they get there? It doesn't mean you need to see their perspective as right, but who are they? How did they get there? And how can their experience actually inform and expand your understanding of the world? And it's hard to do it. And so we all resist it. At least I know I do.
Yeah, entirely. And yet I feel that that is what Jesus Christ stood for. It's what his life exemplified. Yeah. And he can give us the power to do so beyond our own human weakness. And I found that in my own life. I'm so grateful that I don't just have to rely on my own ability, but the more that I lean into that relationship, I feel a greater natural capacity for that work.
Hey everyone, you may have heard me mention Cozy Earth Pajamas on a recent podcast. I don't normally do endorsements, but when Cozy Earth reached out to me because I absolutely love their pajamas, I agreed to promote them on my podcast. I absolutely love the pajamas, and because I agreed, they sent me a few other products, and today I want to talk about their clogs. They're just really comfortable around-the-house clogs. I slip them on all the time. They look like felted wool. I don't know what it is about the style of these things, but I love the look of them. It might be something about growing up in Vermont, New England. They fit the look that I love, and so I wear them all the time. They're very comfortable interior. They're easy to slip on. And they're just adorable looking, and they have a footbed that actually supports you and a shape that looks great. Cozy Earth makes really wonderful products, and through June 1st, you can take advantage of the Memorial Day sale and save 30% with the code JFF30. That's code JFF30 at CozyEarth.com for up to 30% off. And if you see a post-purchase survey, just mention that you heard about Cozy Earth products right here on Conversations with Dr. Jennifer. So I hope you enjoy these clogs and their products as much as I do.
This feels like a really awesome foundation. I'd love to kind of explore these laws, these five laws, and just feel our way through them from this framework. Beginning with obedience, I've read some of your work on obedience that I found to be so fascinating. Spoke on obedience as an important starting point, but perhaps in and of itself, obedience is not a divine principle. You use the phrase, I don't believe in a God who would let us obey our way into godhood, but you spoke on integrity as a divine principle. So I'd love, could you just share some of your thoughts? How are you viewing obedience from a developmental viewpoint?
Yeah. And, you know, language is a big deal because of what we mean by it. And so let me maybe articulate what I mean. I mean, I think when we start out, like in stage one, we need to obey. If you just think about a child and loving parents, they're going to give you rules that help to keep you safe, help to structure your experience because your own understanding hasn't yet caught up to those realities. You don't yet understand that running into the street is a bad idea. You don't understand the danger relative to your size and the cars and so on. And so just obeying makes you safer and helps you graduate to the next stage of life because you just borrowed wisdom. Or even when we go to a doctor, you benefit from, this is more of a stage two idea of obedience, but you benefit from borrowing their wisdom, benefiting from their wisdom rather than you having to go to medical school while the cancer gets you. You know what I mean? Like you don't have to, well, I guess even going to medical school is to borrow wisdom, but you know that you're going to greatly benefit from taking in all the knowledge and understanding that has come before you. And so when we can do that, we can benefit our lives deeply because we aren't just being self-reliant. And so this aligning ourselves with what is good and true helps our development along. And the more we do it, the less we have to learn the hard way. But where I think we can struggle is when we talk to each other from either a stage one frame or even a stage two frame, because what we're doing is we're using fear and self-doubt and dependency to keep people from moving through the stages into a richer understanding of what that might mean. So from stage one, you might obey because you don't want God to, you don't want to burn, you don't want God, you don't want to suffer, right, in the next life. In stage two, you might do it because you want to belong to God, to the group. You want people to think well of you. I need you to feel good about me, for me to feel good about me. That's very much a motivator in that stage. But in stage three, you may well be doing things that look like compliance, but they're being driven by your own discernment that this is in fact good. And so, you know, for example, I think I learned the value of being a good mother growing up in the church. And that was, I was learning the language of my group, inheriting those values, but they also resonated with me as true, right? So when I got to a certain stage, when I actually had the possibility of taking a job that I really, really would have liked, but I had a newborn and a special needs child, and I was really grappling with who am I, what do I value two things that stand in contrast to each other. I value being able to continue to develop in my career and you know, my husband and I were both out of work and looking for work. I value the need to take care of the family. But I value even more within me being the one home with my kids. Like, that's what I value the most. And so I said no to the job offer. And I chose to be home because I was aligning myself with what I really believed mattered most in the scheme of things. But it wasn't for the lesser motivations. Okay, so it was aligning myself with what I really believed was most good for me, in my conscience, in my situation, it may have looked to the outside observer like, oh, she's obeying the idea that women should be good mothers. But what I was really doing was choosing the kind of person I wanted to be true to my conscience, to be true to what I believed was most right, even though there was a loss connected to it. And it's similar to sacrifice in that way, right? It's what's driving the choice. Is it, you know, that the right hand knows what the left hand doeth? That is like the, I want to look good to others. I want the reward. Or is it being driven by this internal motivation to align myself with what my conscience really suggests is most right in this situation? And for me, it was a bit of thinking like, I want to know that I did what I believed was most right, because I don't know how to say it. Like, I wanted to be at peace with myself. Mm-hmm. I wanted in 5 years to not regret. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that there weren't hard things about it. There weren't moments where I thought, man, that job sounds really way better and way easier than what I'm doing right now. That's for sure. But it was truly an expression of me. It was a self-authored choice, informed by my religious upbringing, informed by my family experience, informed by who I was in the world, because for some, that they might land on a very different choice and do it while being very true to their conscience. So I had no need to judge anybody else's choice. I just knew what was right for me. And it was a kind of, I mean, you could call it obedience, because what I was obeying was my conscience, what I really believed was the most right thing to do in my life at that point. And I was submitting to that reality. But it was a willing choice. It wasn't that I was hoping to get some external reward. The reward was the enactment of what I believed was most right.
And feeling that within your conscience.
Yeah. The peace of living in alignment internally.
So it sounds like what motivates us can evolve over time.
Definitely.
So I personally have struggled quite a bit with perfectionism through my life, doing things from this place of insecurity that if I don't do it right, God will abandon me. You know, what moves someone from stage two to stage three, for example? What makes the difference?
Well, it's a great question. So first of all, I think so many of the ideas we have about God are more projections of who our parents were than it is about God. Like, that is, again, seeing the world as we are, not as our parents in heaven are. And so we're often operating from that frame, and we often have many people who see God in the same way. And so they're teaching us, like, no unclean thing can get into heaven, so you can't be a human being and you can't make mistakes. And many of us, well-intentioned, teach each other that, and we learn those ideas. But what I think is that if we start to trust in God, there's a real trust. This trust is a real issue, okay? Like, can I believe in the truth that God actually loves me more than I can understand? That I have value that is immutable. There's nothing I can do to increase my value, and there's nothing I can do to decrease it. I think that takes tremendous faith to trust in that reality. Because what the more egocentric brain wants, what our natural man wants, is I'm going to earn my worthiness. I'm going to basically rise above the human condition and have some control over this. That's what we want. The natural man in us wants control. The soul submits to the process that we're engaged in that grows us up, but it requires trust in love, in a loving God, in goodness, even in a world of suffering and loss and confusion. And so to rise above perfectionism in its core is an act of faith, that I don't have to prove my worthiness, that I don't have to be a slave to everybody's judgment or to my own tyranny, that I get to be a human being and still have value. That's what Christ was trying to teach us. And so can I actually lean into that, even though maybe I grew up learning that people that don't make mistakes get the most credit or the most praise, or, you know, however I learned that idea? Or can I rise above the fear, even if it didn't come from an external messaging, the part of me that thinks if I can get everything right, then I'll be safe? Can I challenge the part of me that wants to believe in that limited idea? But it means pushing ourselves. It means seeing what we're doing, how our ego wants control and wants to set the rules. And this is another way of thinking about obedience in my view, because it's not the reward system. It's that I'm willing to lean into what's real, even though it confuses my sense of control and confuses the world as my more limbic brain wants to believe it is.
Mm. It feels like we're growing in faith. It feels like this process is a process of growing up into faith, greater faith, yes, and trust in God. That's really beautiful. What did it look like for you to come into that relationship of trust with God? Do you feel like it came naturally for you? Did you have to really grow into it?
Well, both yes and no, I would say. Like in some respects, I think because I was born, my parents were imperfect for sure. Mm. But I think I was born into the experience of feeling welcomed and loved and cherished. I think I also was born into a family that saw women as less valuable than men. You know, it's a little too abject sounding, like nobody was being harmed or abused or anything like that. But it was more a system in which men are in charge. Men set the rules. Women are there to support. They are beloved and valued, but they aren't really equals intellectually, and they are inherently and necessarily dependent. And so I also inherited a notion of God that fit with that idea.
Mm.
And so then when I learned about polygamy and so on, it was very confusing for me because I had actually experienced God in this much more loving and expansive way as a younger person. That's how I felt God in my soul. But then when I was learning things about women's relationship to men, as we were understanding it and articulating it, it felt incongruous and it felt distressing and disillusioning for me. And really, in some sense, what it was I was in a crisis of, are other people getting it right and I just don't get it? And I need to just accept that? Or is it something in my conscience and in my soul that's saying this is wrong? And so I was in that conflict of, you know, some fall, right, in that sense, between that sort of borrowing what the group says versus defining what do I believe is right in this, and feeling the fear, I want to belong, but I also want to belong to my own conscience. And so how do those two go together? And in that process, I think I felt a kind of rupture in my relationship with God, because I think I was thinking of God as the social group that was God. And because I wasn't congruent with it, I wasn't in alignment, I didn't see it the same way, that then that understanding of God was dying or distancing from me. I didn't know how. And so either God is real and like that, but disappointed in me, or that's not the truest understanding of God. And so I think there was a period for me, of being in the wilderness, in a sense, like, I don't know who God is. I don't know where God is. I don't know what it means in my life. Mm. But I have to say that while I felt much less clear about God, I still trusted in goodness. Like, that didn't make me lose my conscience or lose like a sense of responsibility to love others and to be good. And so I think I kept sort of choosing in that direction. And I guess what I would say for me is, as I've lived my life, as I've worked with people and watched them integrate more truth into their souls, into their marriages, watch the transformation of people that are living in deeper alignment with what is good and true, my trust and witness of God, of goodness, of truth, of the power of love, of all those things has just become so present for me. For me, it doesn't mean that I've nailed down all the details and I know how all of it works. I don't have that, and I don't even feel as much need for that. But I feel an order in life and in our development that is real and reliable and something that is trustworthy for me. And I feel the trust in a God that wants me to keep bringing my full conscience to my life.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that I might not suffer or lose a great deal. All those things are open possibilities. I don't believe that that shields me from human suffering by any stretch.
Yeah.
But it gives me a kind of reassurance and solace in the face of the inevitable losses that come with living life.
So it sounds like both from your own lived experience and then from the work you do, witnessing the lived experience of so many others, it's taught you the reliability of God, it sounds like, and goodness,
yeah.
Trusting in that inner compass and discernment that it will take you
towards
greater truth.
The inescapable morality of life, the inescapable moral project that we're all involved in.
Mm.
And, you know, sometimes people will say, you know, well, I believe in God like it's an inherent good. But what I care more about is what is the God you believe in asking of you? Does it tell you to fly planes into buildings because someone thinks differently than you do? Okay, because there's not a lot of virtue in that notion of God. Or is our belief in God asking us to bring our conscience and our honesty and our humility and our willingness to keep growing and the expectation to love even when we're not getting the validation or approval or reinforcement that we want, right? That's really, really important, is what does my belief ask of me and am I willing to offer it?
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful and feels empowering as well. Thank you for sharing that. I love that this has ended up being more of an exploration of obedience, which is a wonderful starting point. So let's close this conversation with this ending question that I had, which we touched on earlier. There's this natural tension that occurs because we're all on our own unique journey at different stages of development, and that can feel hard to grapple with. There's that reality that I'm going to be experiencing relating to my faith and my discipleship one way, and it might look entirely different for another person in my community. Mm-hmm. And also the reality that the body of our faith community is on its own developmental journey.
That's right.
Which is an exciting idea for me. It helps me to kind of take a step back and see the bigger picture of, especially yes. a church that believes in continued revelation, that yeah. there's so much more to come. And I yeah. want to hold that vision for my community. So what does it look like to hold space and to hold grace for these realities in the midst of my own journey?
Well, in some ways, it's to forgive life for being so imperfect. I mean, I think it's no shocker when we're born into such an imperfect world, into a world so full of pain and suffering, that we instinctively look for someone to save us from that suffering. Someone that's going to give us the answers, give us all the clarity. And certainly there are people that can give us more safety, more clarity, right? That we can look to parents and leaders and teachers for some anchor in the storm, right? And there's true value in it, as we talked about. We need that. But what we often tend to do is become overly reliant on it and kind of say, well, I will defer my judgment to yours, kind of as you show me how to live happily, I'll depend on you. I won't kind of take on deeper responsibility for myself in this. That's where I have an issue with obedience. If we're giving away our agency, if we're going against our conscience, thinking I'll get rewarded just for going along, rather than the harder work of taking real responsibility for ourselves. So sometimes when we've made that bargain, that I will just go along, not question, but you give me safety, you give me a good life. And I see people do this in marriage even, that we will almost inevitably come up against some disillusionment, some puncture against that system, that doesn't actually work, that there's nobody out there that's going to give us perfect safety, provide us a life, give us all the answers. It just doesn't work that way. And so we can often feel disillusioned and heartbroken by that, and that's understandable. But it's also true that no system ever could or would give us all the answers. You know, like in Catholicism, there's this joke that, like, well, I don't know if it's a joke, but people say, you know, the Pope is perfect, but no one believes it. Mm. In our faith, everyone says the prophet is imperfect, but no one believes it. Okay. So that is, we want the idea that all the answers exist at the top and we just have to go along. And the harder truth is that's not true. Now, I don't envy any of our church leaders' responsibility or position, because it's very hard to be an imperfect person in an uncertain world, imperfectly receiving inspiration and trying to guide a large church. That's so it's always going to be imperfect, which doesn't mean that it's not worth investing our whole selves into. But it's maybe better understanding the larger project, that it's not about, you're going to give me all the answers, and as long as I follow, I get everything I want. But I'm invested in this community of being Christian, followers of God, followers of Christ, trying to do what is good in the larger sense, but sometimes right down at the level of the person that I am a minister to, or the person next to me in sacrament meeting, that I'm here to love these people who think differently than me, who may even judge me, who may, you know, whatever it is, that I'm learning how to create community and a deeper loving connection between myself and other children of God. And it's all imperfect, but that's okay. That's all we get. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, what helps me sometimes is, I think sometimes when I'd get into my self-righteous energy was sort of the fantasy that out there somewhere, somebody had gotten it all right. And somebody was living the perfect life with parents who never made any mistakes, or church leaders who never made mistakes, rather than, that just doesn't seem to be what we get in life. And so will I pick up my part? Will I contribute and do my best? Or will I just blame that others aren't doing their best? Or at least in my, you know, my limited perception, that judgment, but instead deal with the beam in my eye, do what I can to make the world better. That's what it means to be devoted to anything, is that you're going to bring your best to it.
That's beautiful. It feels like there's just all of the invitation for grace in every stage. The individual, for the other, for the community, that's what God is asking of us and inviting us into. It's never going to be perfect. And the real work and the real growth happens when we face the reality of life and turn towards it and hold it for what it is, and then devote ourselves to love and showing up to the best of our abilities and trusting in love and in goodness that it's going to take us into something greater.
Yes, exactly. We want control, but I think the gospel and love is there to show us, point us to what we need more than control.
I love that. Jennifer, thank you so much. I love that. There's so much I wanted to talk to you about, but this felt so potent, just this conversation on obedience. So thank you so much for everything that you shared. I'm going to continue just pondering it and exploring it. It feels really, really helpful for me, just having this framework. So thank you for sharing, for taking the time. And excited to share this with the community.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.